stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 268 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Montreal, Quebec, Canada, I am Andrew Brokus, joined by Nate Mavis in Melrose, Massachusetts.
Hi, Andrew, how are you?
I'm good. I feel like I'm practically your neighbor now, given how far away I've been from you lately.
Yeah. We're in the same time zone. It's wild.
It certainly makes scheduling easier.
Yeah, absolutely. How's Montreal treating you?
It's been pretty good. I've been coming here at least once a year. I think I've done it every September since 2012. In 2011, I was elsewhere in Canada, but I haven't missed WCOOP since Black Friday, although I was pretty close to missing it this year. I think I mentioned the only reason I'm playing it this year, I ended up having a free place to stay in Montreal with a friend here whose roommate moved out recently, but definitely seeing less value. I mean, it's been pretty clear decline in value every year since Black Friday, but the fields are getting a lot smaller. The higher buy-in events, for the first time this year, PokerStars is doing WCOOP the way they've always done Scoop, which is that there's high, medium, and low buy-ins for each event. So instead of just having like a 1K yesterday, there was a 1K, a $100, and a $10, all in the progressive knockout format. So they're all the same format, but they're three different buy-in levels, each 10 times bigger than the last. And I mean, field sizes have been getting smaller every year anyway, so I don't know how much this is just the natural decline of things, but I think particularly given that there's been medium buy-in things, like I haven't played a single of the highest buy-in events yet. The two 1K tournaments that I've played have both been mediums when there was also a 10K running, and all of the highest buy-in events have been like very small fields of fewer than 500, in some cases fewer than 200 players. And it's just, there's a lot of good people playing online right now. So, that part has been, it's been okay, but not fantastic. And the weather here usually is really lovely in September, but as I'm sure you know, it's been really hot and humid lately. So, I did manage to get a bike ride in this morning, but I went at like 7 a.m.
Yeah, it's been hot, but don't have to shovel heat, so I'm cool with it.
How's life in Melrose?
Well, life in Melrose is great. I'm aware that I'm always announcing a new hobby on this show, but I'm now 10 weeks into some sort of running regimen and loving it. And nutrition Twitter. So it was funny when poker Twitter sort of became crypto Twitter for a while. I mean, it still is partly like that, but like now poker Twitter is also like keto Twitter, yeah. And things like this, yeah, which is like, yeah, it's just strange. I mean, it's very similar to like crypto Twitter in that like people who just learned about economics or nutrition a month ago now claim to be experts on it, or poker Twitter for that matter. Boy, we don't know anything about nutrition just like as a species. I think.
Yeah, it's kind of surprising to me that, like, I sort of thought when I started taking it seriously that I was going to be able to find something that would just be like, okay, here are the things you should eat and here's how much of each one. And there are things that essentially do that, but they don't seem to do it with a high degree of confidence.
Yeah, and there's like an equally reputable source that'll tend to say the opposite.
Exactly.
So, so I'm trying to be sensible, but like, yeah, it's tough because like I was not in running form and like almost, I mean, for a few different reasons, I just need to get a little leaner. So I'm like combining weight loss with nutrition with like healthy running nutrition and trying to do both of those things at the same time, which I think is pretty common, but not all the things you're trying to accomplish with those two goals are the same. And boy, is it hard to combine those. So that's one thing I'm up to, but that's good. I don't know. I like it. I live near the Middlesex Fells Reservation, as people out here will know. It's like 2,500 acres, mostly forest. So I've discovered trail running, and I think it's nice. And yeah, it's pretty easy to lose money running, but not too much of it. And it's pretty hard to lose lots of money running. So that's nice. So it's on average, it's more expensive than tournament poker, but the variance is much lower.
I probably told the story on the podcast, but it's been years when Emily and I were living in San Francisco and Gareth came to visit us. He did a race in the sort of South Bay, a sort of very ritzy area in the South Bay, and literally everyone else there was wearing all this kind of high-tech performance gear. I mean, the clothing, yeah. And they had all the hydration tools, and just everything about them was fancy. And Gareth was just like the 100% complete opposite. You know, his shoes are like falling apart. He's wearing just like an old sweaty t-shirt and like gym shorts. I think he was carrying a water bottle. Like, it was just... The contrast could not have been sharper.
Yeah. It's I'm doing a pretty good job. Like, all I've bought so far is shoes and underwear, which I think is like pretty sensible.
Yeah, those seem like the first two things you would want to invest in.
Yeah. But it's amazing how much stuff there is out there.
And you were a runner in high school?
Yeah, I was a runner in high school, so like one of my
I knew you swam. I don't think I knew about the running.
Yeah, I ran more than I swam. I was probably better at swimming than running the year I did it, my senior year. But I ran a lot. I ran a lot. So two seasons a year, cross country and track. So that's it's a part of it's a part of what fall feels like for me. Is inhaling nice smelling fall air in pain and desperately.
So today's show, we don't have a guest because I've been pretty unclear on my own schedule with WCOOP running, but I think people hopefully won't mind that too much, and we've got plenty of mailbox questions and hands to go through, and I have a hand of my own that I hope to brag about on air. But first off, I thought we could start with this one, which is not really a strategy question. This is just an email that we got. Hi, Andrew and Nate. I just wanted to thank you both for the podcast and especially for the book recommendations that are sprinkled throughout. In particular, thanks for proselytizing David Foster Wallace. Infinite Jest has blown my mind several times over, even if I consume it as an audiobook, which Andrew has said can't work. Once again, thanks so much. You have kept me company as I have painted many, many square meters of many, many houses in suburban Southwest Western Australia. Warm regards, John. So, I mean, first off, thanks, John. That's awesome. Glad you're enjoying David Foster Wallace. I still have trouble wrapping my head around how you would listen to that as an audiobook. I think if you've already... It sounds like he said even as an audiobook, so I don't know if he's also read the... Like, so I think if you read it once already, I could kind of see doing it again in audiobook. It's hard for me to imagine keeping everything straight in audiobook form, but maybe some people are just better at audiobooks than I am.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be different. I think the experience would be different, but I also think, things are different in translation too, but sometimes something is gained in translation. I think it would be weird just to hear, like, tagged to a footnote. Here right. is the full filmography of, what's-his-face, the dad.
Yeah.
Daddy in Condensa. Yeah, that'd be pretty strange, I think. But, I don't know, like, there aren't, like, a lot of pictures. There's not a lot that depends on like orthographic trickery or jokes. So I tend to like to consume fiction not just in books but in like dead tree books, like even on Kindle. I know I sound old, but I've done fairly extensive testing here, and for me I like the paper. I retain it better. It's a better experience for me. So yeah, audiobooks, you know, it's cool. Reading is good. Reading in every form is good. And especially if you're painting houses, probably a lot better. Yeah, it's sure, probably a lot easier to listen to it than it is to read it while you're painting a house.
Yeah, I mean, in addition to like the weird footnotes, the other thing, I mean, there's just a lot of complicated sentence structures and a lot of very long sentences where I feel like I would get lost. I mean, I did get lost reading, and I had to sort of go back and kind of see what was the subject of the sentence again. And it's a little harder to do that in an audiobook, especially when you're painting.
Really? I imagine. So I think there's a lot that can be gained there. I think that's a good example. So, like, when I was trying to read ancient Greek, in reading group, it could be easier because now the leader of the reading group, like when a really good person at Greek would take his or her turn, they would read, and like, yeah, you get a lot of sentences with complicated structure, and you can do a lot with your voice to indicate like, oh, this is a subordinate clause. It's and that can be useful, especially if you're reading a language where word order does not give you as much help as it does in modern English. I don't know. Maybe it could help. I'm pretty like open-minded / skeptical about this stuff. I think if he's getting something out of it, then he's probably a good judge of that. Like I've never tried the audiobook form.
Look, I'm not telling him not to listen to the audiobook. I'm just saying surprising to me that he's able to do it, but I'm glad that he's able to do it.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, it's surprising to me too, but like, I don't know. I'll say I put a lot of time into thinking about how to like consume books and such, and I'm always surprised and nothing makes sense. Like the path of the world's information from books into brains, I think, is something we don't understand very well. You know, nutrition is poorly understood in, you know, also intellectually, I think. So who knows how it goes.
Well, on the subject of literature recommendations, you kind of indirectly prompted me. You mentioned on a recent show the Great American Novel and this Wikipedia list of like candidates for the Great American Novel, and so I decided to look through that and see what all was on there. I mean, we speculated about some of it on the air, and I came across one title. I'd never read anything by Don DeLillo before, but I came across Underworld, which I started, and I'm about a third of the way into it so far, and I'm liking it quite a bit. I was kind of aware that DeLillo had been a big influence on David Foster Wallace, but you can see it, I think, very clearly reading Underworld. I mean, I don't know anything else about DeLillo other than what I've read in this book, but I think the similarities between this book and Infinite Jest, both in terms of how it's written and to some degree the subject matter, it's very easy to see some parallels there. There's also a lot of baseball in this book, so that may be of interest to you if you've not read it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've read a little bit of DeLillo, Sorry, one second.
Yeah, I wasn't sure on the pronunciation.
White Noise, is White Noise DeLillo? Yes, yes, I've read a little bit of DeLillo. That's the one. I'll say I haven't, you know, from like 1960 to 1995, especially people who were considered like experimental and cutting-edge-y, then that's not something I know a lot about. So I'll be interested to hear what you say.
Honestly, that was part of what it kept me away from him, was thinking it was going to be like, I'm really not a big fan of the kind of like, I think he's considered like a postmodern novelist. I don't really find the book, it's not like difficult to follow. I mean, it's the plot structure is similar to Infinite Jest, and there's a lot of kind of like jumping around and like going from perspectives of different characters and things, but it's not like difficult to follow. It's not like written weirdly. It's not reading what's the guy who cut things up and just put them together in random orders.
I don't know what you're talking about, but you know,
it's a pretty famous Burroughs, William S. Burroughs.
Oh yeah.
Right. So this is nothing like Burroughs. Like, it's not nearly that incomprehensible. It's very comprehensible.
Yeah, well, that's good. I will check it out. I'm currently, like, yeah, I'm right now in the middle of, I think, more books than I intend to finish than I've ever been in the middle of before. like, I actually think I'm going to finish all these books, just for whatever reason. I'm in the middle of a lot of them right now. Can I brain dump these? Is that of any interest? Yeah. So Daniels's Running Formula, very good. The Art of Learning, highly recommended by a lot of people. I would say I rate it. Yeah, I would say so far I rate it like a little bit less high than other people do, but it's still like well worth reading, and I like it. High Spirits is a book of ghost stories by Robertson Davies, which I really like so far. I wanted to read The Ghost Who Vanished by Degrees, in part because it's an intertextual reference in the late part of A Prayer for Owen Meany, which is a book I just finished by John Irving, who I think has been completely forgotten, which is weird to me because, like, I feel like when I was an undergrad, he was considered maybe a little bit on the popular side of things, but like a capital M, capital A major author. And now, like, nobody talks about him ever anymore. Like, it's just like this is zero. Like, I could literally can't remember the time I heard somebody mention John Irving. A Prayer for Owen Meany just knocked me on my butt. Yeah, it took me about 17 years to finish that book after I first started it, but yeah, that was really good. I'm in the middle of a book called My Heart is Broken by Mavis Gallant. It's a Canadian book. It's a bunch of short stories. It's good so far. I think I'm going to finish that one. Contemporary Abstract Algebra by Joe Gallion. A lot of good abstract algebra books out there. This one has a different perspective. Really useful. Like it a lot. And what else? The Corrections. Yeah, I find so far I like Freedom better. I see more of the reasons why people criticize Franzen in The Corrections, and I have a hard time reading too much of it at once. Like it feels a little more like candy or trickery to me, and it's also just really, really, really sad. But you know, it's good. It's good. I mean, it's hard. Yeah, I mean, I think he's like an undeniably very talented and perceptive writer, and I'm glad he's writing books that I can read. So those are the books that I'm in the middle of, and I actually expect to finish all of them. It's weird for me to be in the middle of that many books. It's even weirder for me to like think I'm going to finish all of them. So that is what I'm reading.
I had a couple of podcast recommendations also, I guess, while we're on the fiction subject. I've been listening on and off for a while to the New Yorker Fiction podcast, which is just, they have a current New Yorker author, like someone who has published fiction in the New Yorker recently, choose a story from the New Yorker's archives, and this is like once a month, that person, so the story is read by an author, but not the author of that story. And then the person will discuss a little bit with the fiction editor of the New Yorker. And that's kind of mixed quality, so I just like to do it sometimes. I think that oftentimes the stuff that's published in the New Yorker is a little weirder than what I'm interested in fiction-wise, but I mean, they're certainly capable of publishing some good stories. And the most recent episode was Stone Mattress by Margaret Atwood. I'd read The Silent Assassin by Margaret Atwater, and I really did not like it and was not terribly inclined to read anything else by her. But I thought this particular short story was really excellent. And I think in particular, it's a very straightforward story. So I think for people who anything like literary is sort of a turnoff for them, this is not there's nothing at all complex narratively going on. There's nothing, like it's sort of the most meat and potatoes sort of story that you could imagine, but I think it's kind of very well written, very compelling, and I think the discussion around it is really interesting as well. So if people want to listen to fiction, I would recommend that over the Infinite Jest audiobook and going through the archives of the New Yorker Fiction podcast, which has been around for quite some time now. I'm sure you could find other stories that you'd be interested in. Like if you like either the author of the story or the author who's reading the story, you know, either way, you're likely to come away with something interesting there. The other one that I've been listening to is Bundyville, which is just a short, I think it's like six or seven parts that are about half an hour each from Oregon Public Radio. And this is about Clive and Bundy and that clan, which is kind of the group, I think they're most famous for having occupied the Malheur National, I think it's a wildlife refuge in Oregon. And I really didn't know much more about them other than that. And I think this is a pretty fair, I mean, the person definitely has like a perspective on it, but I think she does a pretty good job of kind of telling the Bundys' story or letting the Bundys, I mean, they're interviewed on the podcast also. But I think it's doing a pretty good job of presenting fairly. Like, I certainly understand where they're coming from better than I did. Like, there's many times where they're sympathetic, and then just sort of big have a chance to talk about black people or something like that, and then they're less sympathetic. But there are certainly times where I find myself sympathizing with the Bundys in listening to this, which is pretty interesting. So I don't know that it would be of much interest to people outside of the U.S., although maybe it would. I mean, I think a lot of people struggle to understand the sort of far-right fringe in the United States. I certainly do. And I've found that a pretty helpful perspective, not just on that particular family, but sort of the whole militia movement in the United States. It seems like a good introduction to that, although I don't know that I would be qualified to judge what is a good introduction to that.
Very good. Well, thank you. Can I say one more thing before we get into, like, proper strategy?
Of course.
Yeah, so last week we had a procedural question, which is about dealers automatically counting bets, and I refer you to that if you want my whole thing about how dealers, I think, should not automatically count bets. But I failed to mention two of the very most important considerations. Number one is that other things equal, the dealers and your opponents should not be touching chips. Chips are not there to be touched. Anytime a chip gets touched, that's a chance for it to get stolen or palmed or whatever. Or at least that's the traditional view. It's almost completely lost, so I don't know what to make of that old-fashioned poker principle now, but I think that's part of why bets were not automatically counted all the time, at least traditionally. And the second one is that our original correspondent said, oh, there's this complicated set of rules about whether it's being raised or called. And I think another reason for that is that there's like another principle, which is in tension with the first one, which is that chips that are called money should be in the middle and not on the perimeter of the table. Like money that is in the middle of the table is more secure than money that is near the perimeter of the table. And that's why when you call when a bet gets raised, that's why it's often, you know, other things equal. Again, there are complicated rules about this in a lot of places. Why the called money gets pulled in, ideally pushed in with the side of the hand rather than grabbed with the whole hand. So I think those are two, I think, important bits of background I was kicking myself all week as I walked the dog for not mentioning, and now I have mentioned them, and now you know more about this issue.
Good. I think those are helpful principles to keep in mind.
And that's why I'm right and you're wrong. Okay, good. Next time.
Well, this is a Diving Into the Mailbag episode, and as it happens, Diving Into the Mailbag is also the subject of my latest series on Tournament Poker Edge. Very often, I would say more often than not, when people ask poker questions, whether it's writing into the show or on the Tournament Poker Edge forums or conversations I'm having with my students, I think the more important thing isn't really answering their specific question, like, should I have called this turn raise, or something like that. The more important thing is finding, like, what's the fundamental understanding, maybe even in how they're framing the question in the first place, or what is it that makes this a difficult thing for them to figure out for themselves? Why is this a thing that they need, or how do they get into this bad spot in the first place? Or sometimes there's just a problem with how they're framing the situation in the first place. So in this series on Tournament Poker Edge, I'm doing a deep dive into questions from the Tournament Poker Edge forum or the Thinking Poker mailbag, and trying to explain what I think are the key misunderstandings that underlie some commonly asked questions. So I'm, you know, just picking a single question, but the goal is not really just to answer that one question. Rather, it's to say, you know, what is the common misunderstanding that's reflected in this question that I think, you know, that both the author of this question and many other people learning poker would do well to learn from. And you'll find that series and much more on tournamentpokeredge.com.
Good. So you're like a poker therapist. So, like, if I go to you and I say, like, you know, why, how can I stop losing money all the time? Or, you know, it's like how can I improve my percentage of winning sessions? You'll say, like, whoa, 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 let's think about, you know, why you're thinking in those terms in the first place. Is that fair?
I would say that I am like a poker therapist. That is probably not one of the top five reasons why I am like a poker therapist, although it may be on the list.
All right. All right, very good.
Did you also have a follow-up thing you wanted to say, or not follow-up, I guess, but you wanted to discuss the conversation that you were having with Dara on Twitter?
Yeah, I mean, I would. We could do that this week. We could do it next week. We've been going a fair amount of time already. I would be happy to do that. It's how about I let you choose? I'm more than happy to talk about it, and I intensely care about what you have to say about it. Yeah, okay, let's talk about it. So Dara just wrote a blog post where he said that he does better without days off sometimes at poker, and you know, he part of the goal of the blog post is to call into question the needing days off mentality, and you know, feeling like you know, there's something healthy about grinding every day, at least for him, and he felt better this summer, and he was in no days off mode. And I as I thought about it, so first, Dara's a runner, and I thought of you, because the question that Dara made me think is, you know, why are you taking this day off? You know, like the same way that you often like to say, you know, like, what specifically are you trying to accomplish with this bet? You know, you say you want to thin the field. Why do you want to thin the field? And I think that there's really a hole in popular poker thought about days off, where people will say, like, oh, I don't want to get burned out, or, oh, you know, 40 days in a row is too many to play, or, oh, I need some time off. I'm going to take one day now and one day in a week instead of, like, 2 days right now. And I think they're really failing to answer the question, like, what specific purpose does this have? Like, you can't just sort of throw time at yourself, I think, and expect it to have a good psychological effect. And I think Dara's running background is helpful here, because runners think a lot about how many off days they need. And crucially, good ones know exactly why they're doing it. They're going to say, like, oh, I need to get lactic acid out of my muscles. I actually don't know if that's a thing. Or I need, you know, like, I can only put this much strain on my knees in a given amount of time, and I need to not strain my knees tomorrow. I need to go 36 hours without putting pressure on my bursae, whatever. And in poker, I don't hear that very often. Like, one thing I hear a lot of is, like, screw poker, I'm not going to play tomorrow. another thing I hear a lot is, like, oh, my God, the Rio, the effing Rio, like, ugh, I'm not going to play tomorrow. Or, like, oh, I'm on the grind, I'm going to play 50 days in a row. And I don't hear any kind of, like, mechanistic explanation there, and I don't hear much at all about what specific purpose people intend their breaks or days off to serve. So I guess I would like to know what when you're thinking about planning your schedule, like, what specific purposes do you view your days off as serving, or are you not thinking about this carefully enough?
Those are my only two options.
Or something else. No.
This is a timely question, because today is the first day off that I've had since I got to Montreal. It's currently Friday, so I played the first Sunday of W Coupe, and I've played every day since. So I played for 5 days. Now I'm taking a day off, and then I'll most likely play tomorrow, and then I'll definitely play Sunday. I tend not to plan my days off. So I kind of have a set, like, if I'm doing a series like W Coupe or WSOP, I mean, I have certain days that are, like, high priorities, and so if I start to feel the need for a day off coming on, I'll want to address that before, you know, like, I'm not going to take a day off on, like, the last Sunday of W Coupe. So, if I think it's likely that I'm going to need a day off, then I'll try to plan to have one, like, the Friday or Saturday before that Sunday. In terms of, so, you know, but I tend not to just, like, straight build that into my schedule, unless there's something that I really have to schedule. If a friend's going to be in town or something like that, then, you know, I'll sort of try to find a day that's not important to me to play, and that'll be a planned day off because there's something that I want to do that day. But if it's just for the purpose of taking a break from poker, I like to be flexible enough that I can wake up and see how I feel that day. And sometimes I'm feeling energized. If I feel like I've been playing well, and I'm not getting tired, then, you know, I'll want to keep playing and be in that zone. For me, I don't know that I've ever played 7 days straight. I'm not even sure I've ever played 6 days straight. So for me personally, like, I do tend to kind of be a little sick of it. And I don't necessarily have a goal other than just I don't think I'd play that well. Like, I don't think you play well if you don't want to be there. If you're just kind of going through the motions and you're like, oh, fuck poker, but I guess I'm going to, you know, show up because hashtag no days off. You know, I don't think you're really doing yourself any favors by showing up and playing that day, especially in a tournament where you at any time, your brain has the opportunity to just punt and go home. Like, if your brain doesn't want to be there, putting it in a position where it can sort of convince itself to punt the chips off and let you go home, like, you're better off just staying home that day. So I would say that's the number one thing for me, is more just there, like, I reach a point where I suspect I'm not going to play well on a particular day, and it might be planned, and it might just be that I wake up, I didn't sleep well the night before, and I'm like, eh, I just don't feel like it today, and then I don't go. And there's plenty of days when I do feel energized about playing poker, and I have other ways to monetize my time, or you can do, you know, podcast recording like I'm doing now. So I don't really feel that compelled. Like, most days, I don't feel like poker is mandatory.
Yeah, that's good. That makes sense. But even there, there's like an empirical justification. It's like I won't play well if I play too long. I will be unhappy if I play too long. And they're at least, like, you have a reason for doing what you're doing, mm-hmm. I think. And that's really important. And I think a lot of people don't.
I don't know. I mean, you think a lot of people are doing it just sort of for having an abstract sense of, like, one ought to take days off?
Yeah, I do think so. Or they're, like, upset, so they take a day off. But it's not clear, like, for the reasons that you won't be happy if you play poker, like, it's clear that a day off will help that. Like, there are people who take days off because they just don't, you know, like, they have no bankroll management. Deep down, they're not sure they're winners. They're not sure they're making a good decision in life playing poker, etc. They take a day off. Like, how is that going to help? You know, yeah, like, fair. I mean, people feel like that at work all the time. The thing to do is not to skip work, right? Like, you know, like, people do have weekends, and that's healthy. But, like, I see a lot of day-off behavior that I think is not, certainly not optimized, and I think is not even thought through. Like, I think there's not a specific purpose behind it. Yeah. I mean, there's also a lot of playing behavior that doesn't have a specific purpose behind it, so.
Yeah, a lot of people are not thoughtful in a lot of the things you do. But no, you're right. I mean, it's not something I've really explicitly thought about before. Like, that was all an explanation that I came up with just now. I definitely did not have, like, a theory of days off.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I do think you're sensible, but I think it's a place to work on. Like, you said that you were trying to schedule things out this summer to avoid burnout, you know, and that included a different kind of living situation and more days off, and more different rooms, like less time in the Rio and also more variety. Like, did that work? Did it help?
I think so. But again, a lot of that was more just giving myself permission. Like, I guess I tend to feel obliged once I'm in Las Vegas, and we know how it is, like, when you're there and you know that there's, like, not just poker but, like, good games going on, I always have this feeling of, like, I guess it's a FOMO essentially, feeling like, oh, there's like a good opportunity going on right now, particularly with tournaments where it's like anyone could be the one that you're gonna, you know, win big in or something. Like, you always feel like the one that you skipped is the one that would have been a six-figure cash. So there's like that kind of gambler's itch, which I don't really want to indulge, I guess, but it's there. I forget what was the question in the trip. Oh, yeah, how successful was it, like, planning that stuff? I guess a lot of it is just based on kind of empirically one of the things that I wasn't enjoying that much that I was doing anyway, and one of them was spending a lot of time at the Rio.
Yep, good. That makes a lot of sense.
My main priority for today, I have this hand that I emailed to you, Nate, yesterday, and now I wish I hadn't emailed it to you, because I would have liked to have gotten your thoughts on it without knowing the results.
Can I make a confession to you?
You didn't read it?
It's been a really busy day, and it's starred. It's at the top of my mailbox.
No, but, like, this is partly great. This is good news.
Yeah, no, it's good news, but, like, I do in fact read all your poker emails, and like and they're really, really good. So like if I'm just in line at the grocery store or something, I don't read it because it's actually thoughtful. Whereas like other people, and this is good too, like they might just write a note saying like holy crap, I just played a 7K pot. And then I like, you can do that in the grocery store line. It's just like, oh fuck, huh, he had a straight, huh. Like, and then that's it. But like your emails are not like that. So you do in fact have yeah, I haven't read it.
Okay, awesome. This is wonderful. So as I mentioned, I've mostly been steering clear of the higher buy-in WCOOP events. And this, so yesterday I played the $1,000 progressive knockout, which is only the second 1K that I played. Pretty much everything else I've played has been, you know, 500 or lower buy-ins. And even with the 1Ks, I've been a little on the fence and kind of like eye the field before I decide whether to register them. But this one had $1 million guarantee, so you know it's going to get at least 1,000 runners, and it's a progressive knockout, so you don't really want to late register it because all the money is, you know, late registering knockout tournaments is not a good idea. Bounty tournaments, because the prize pool gets paid out. Like, you can't win bounties that have already, you know, been collected before you were there, and you want to have more chips than people at your table. Don't late register knockout tournaments. So I didn't want to late register, and I was like, well, you know, these things are pretty big fields, but certainly there's a ton of really good players playing, and there's always the chance that you're going to end up with, you know, somebody really good at your starting table. So yeah, I join, and three seats to my left maybe is C. Darwin too, who's one of the most successful online turners, a Swedish player. I don't even know if his real name is public information, but one of the most successful online players. And I was like, oh great, C. Darwin too, awesome. But early in these tournaments, there's a lot of shuffling tables around, and a lot of people are late registering, even though it's a bad idea in these tournaments. And so pretty soon he gets moved to another table. And I was like, oh great. And then Mr. Sweets 28 takes a seat, which for people who don't know is Phil Galfond. And I was like, oh, lovely, Phil Galfond. Instead. Perfect. And nothing pretty, he's kind of across the table from me, so nothing much has happened for a while. You know, I haven't really been, he hasn't been a thorn in my side particularly or anything like that. I mean, I'm sure he's taking money that maybe I could have won some of otherwise, but not, hasn't been that big of a thing that he's been at the table. And then this hand comes up. This is at the 500, 1,000 with a 125 ante level. I have just over 100 big blinds, 106,000 in chips. And Phil Galfond has 150,000 in chips. And now there's a third player in this hand who has about 60,000. And yeah, that's 60 big blinds, but Phil and I both cover him. And the player also has a bounty on him, which is worth somewhere in the neighborhood of 12,500 chips. It's not an exact science figuring out, like translating from bounty cash into chips, but it's a quarter of a buy-in, and a buy-in was, you know, it's worth 50,000 chips in your starting stack, so the, you know, the bounty should be worth something like a quarter of a starting stack. And in a progressive knockout tournament, you do want to put some priority on trying to win bounties from players, and sometimes that's going to change the way that you play hands, where you might otherwise be more aggressive, for instance. But if you're trying to keep a player who has a bounty on them in the pot, then you might choose to play some strong hands more passively. And likewise, sometimes you might fast play hands you wouldn't otherwise, or get it in a little lighter preflop when you're trying to isolate a player who has a bounty on them. So there are things about the bounty tournament that will change how you would, you know, you will cause you to play hands differently from how you would in a non-bounty tournament. So this particular hand, I'm under the gun, I have a little over 100 big blinds, and I'm dealt ace-king of hearts. So I raise to 22-22, which is a thing I like to do online, because I just have to push one button, just click it four times. So I raise to 22-22, which is 2.222 times the big blind, under the gun with my ace-king of hearts. And the next act player raises to 7,000. This is the player who has about 60,000 to start the hand. He raises to 7,000. And my plan, if it comes back around to me, is going to be to 4-bet and get it in. Typically, in a tournament, it's not necessarily what I would look to do. If I have 60 big blinds, I have ace-king suited, I open under the gun, and under the gun 1 3-bets me. There's a good chance I'm just going to call and go to a flop rather than get it in for 60 big blinds when we're under the gun and under the gun 1. But in a bounty tournament, when I cover that player, I'm going to want to just 4-bet and get it all in. So that's my plan, is I'm going to be 4-betting and getting it in for 60 blinds. However, Phil Galfond wakes up and cold 4-bets. So now, Phil, I've raised to 22-22, gets 3-bet to 7,000, and Galfond makes it 16,500. Folds back around to me. I have 100,000 chips. What do you want to do now?
Well, this is tough. This is very tough. Have you been active?
I've probably been one of the less active players at the table. I mean, this is an online table with a couple of well-known internet players. I mean, yeah, like I've been reasonably active, but I'm probably not in the top half of the table in terms of how many pots I've been playing.
Yeah. This is tough. Well, so if you think that Phil is doing this light often enough, it's pretty good to 5-bet and get folds sometimes, etc. If you think that Phil is doing this pretty tight, then you have a lot of reasons to fold because you're pretty deep and ace-king suited is unlikely to stack up well against a bluff light 4-betting range. Like, there are certainly spots to fold here.
I mean, let me say this much. Phil is definitely never folding to a 4-bet shove from the guy with 60 big blinds. Like, I think it's very unlikely. Just with the bounty being involved, I don't think that Phil's ever going to be 4-betting. Like, I think whatever he's doing, he's prepared to put in 60K against a player who has a bounty on him. I'm pretty sure that's true.
Yep, I think that's right. And that's probably going to happen often enough. So probably pure bluffs are out, but
yeah, that's the other value thing. I think it's very unlikely. Like, I think the player with the bounty on him, when you have a bounty on you, you expect to get action when you're playing. So I mean, this guy's got 60K chips. It's not like his bounty is going to be. You know, if he had 20 big blinds, then like he's definitely getting called. You know, like, no one ever folds when someone has 20 big blinds. But you know, he's got like 60 big blinds, so it's not like 100% guaranteed that the money's going to go in. But when a player with a bounty on him is covered by an under the gun raiser and 3-bets that under the gun raiser, like, he probably has a hand that he's prepared to play for stacks. Like, he has to figure that I'm going to be pretty interested in, you know, A, I'm raising under the gun, I probably have a pretty good hand, and if I cover him, I'm not going to fold a pretty good hand. So, I mean, I think he's, you know, I think he has a hand that he's ready to play for his stack against what he expects will be a slightly wider than usual stack off range. And
yeah, so Phil,
to know all of that.
Yeah, so like, Phil is not just like, oh, I have ace five of clubs. That right. is a bluffing hand.
Exactly.
Like, that's just, yeah. So I think cold calling might be better here than a bunch of our listeners might think. A lot of people just don't like to cold call ace king in this spot or ever. If you do that, you leave the player with the bounty in, which usually is a bad thing or at least a mixed thing, but here is a little bit better. If he calls, then you keep the chance to win his bounty. If he re-raises, then the action will be opened up to you again and you'll know more. The question of what you'll do with that information is interesting, and possibly the answer is not much. But I think a lot of people would not consider cold calling here, but I'm not so sure. But I think that would be a mistake. I think it is to be considered. Yes, you're out of position, but you have ace-king suited. That's a great hand. And you stand to win bounties, and people stand to give you action if you hit anything. Is it crazy to consider cold calling?
No, calling is what I ended up doing. It did not immediately occur to me as an option, right? I have that same aversion to, like, cold calling ace king when you're definitely drawing a third player into the pot. Like, ordinarily ace king, you're pretty interested in getting fold equity with it. You're a lot more interested in playing it heads up than multi-way. Like, if I have aces here, it's not so big of a deal to let that player call for a good price, because a bunch of the hands, even when they're getting a good price, it's still pretty hard for them to outflop aces, and sometimes they might flop a hand that's actually dominated, and you know, I end up getting more money and good after the flop with aces. That doesn't tend to be so true with ace king. Like when there's this kind of action pre-flop, and then there's an ace on the board, people don't make a lot of mistakes. Like maybe you catch someone with ace queen, but even then, it's like it's not always trivial to get them to stack off with ace queen. But you know, people aren't really stacking off with like queens on an ace high board when like it's a three-way three bet pot. You tend not to have a lot of implied odds with ace king in these kinds of spots, and you're not often really interested in giving a really good price to some other player to call and let it go three ways, nor in playing ace king out of position. So my first thoughts were, well, I could shove. Fold. You're shoving is like risking 100k to win 25 to 30 that's in the pot now, and I do think Phil's range is very strong. I also think the guy, you know, three betting under the gun plus one has a pretty strong range, so I wasn't that excited. You know, if I could be sure that Phil was going to fold and I was just going to get it all in against under the gun one, like that's a very good outcome for me. So like that would be a great outcome, but I was not sure that was going to happen. It did seem like a little too good of a hand to fold. Honestly, ace-king offsuit, it may have just folded it. Ace-king suited's a little safer to take to a flop out of position multi-way. And I'm not getting a terrible price. I mean, Phil's 4-bet is pretty small. The 3-bet is sizable. The 3-bet is to, you know, I opened to 22-22. The 3-bet's to 7,000. Phil's 4-bet is only to 16,500. So it's not a lot more. You know, it's you know, barely 2x the 3-bet. So I'm not getting a terrible price to call. I also think because this is a bounty, it's a lot more plausible that I might just flat here with not just aces, but even like kings or queens to try to draw the player with the bounty in. Like if I had queens here, I wouldn't really be that excited about just jamming it into Galfond's cold 4-bet either. So I think that I can... there's actually a fair number of strong hands that I would want to flat here. I'm not sure that I would pick up in the moment on flatting with aces being a good idea, but looking at the situation now, I do actually think even flatting with aces or kings is a pretty good idea, partly because it's going to look very strong to 5-bet, and partly because keeping that player with the bounty in the pot is a pretty appealing thing to do. So I don't even know that I'm really... like, because part of the problem with cold calling is you often just tend to sort of flag yourself as having like a good but not great hand. You know, when people cold call a 3-bet or a 4-bet, it's often, you know, jacks, queens, tens, like sort of in that neighborhood. And once people have that information, then they can play pretty well against you. But I think that I can... like, my hand is still kind of concealed when I cold call, which was also appealing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the sort of basic things that comes up in a lot of hold'em spots is like playing against exactly tens or jacks is yeah, very easy, but playing against probably tens or jacks but maybe ace king is vastly harder.
And maybe aces. Like,
yeah, that too. But even a little bit of ace king goes a long way. You know, it's like those rare earth metals or whatever that you need.
It's the cadmium of poker. Okay, so and my plan here was if the short stack were to shove and Phil reshoved, I would be folding. But I don't think it's that trivial for Phil to reshove because I think that I could have aces. So I think if Phil has a hand like even as strong as queens, certainly jacks or tens, it's not going to be trivial for him to just jam and isolate that short stack because there's a real chance that he's going to be jamming into like a kind of slow played aces or kings. So I felt like I could call here and not necessarily get blown out of the pot.
Yeah, and like just again, I think something that's in the background here that some of our listeners might disagree with us about is that I think if you had sevens here and it went like that, you would just fold in like pretty easily.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Like it's not close, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm going to be reasonably well balanced when I call here between hands that can call a shove from Phil and hands that can't. Like I think it's not obvious what he should be doing if he has say ace king.
Yeah, exactly, which is why you can fold. Like, I think some people will say, like, oh, if you call, you're showing weakness. It's like, no, weak hands cannot call.
Right, like, I need a pretty strong hand even to call.
Yeah. It's not like, I might hit a set. It's like, no, this is not that spot.
I'm not going to be, like, folding 80% of my hands if Phil jams. Like, this is the bottom of my calling range.
Good.
So I call, and thankfully the short stack just calls. So I do get to see a flop for, you know, not, I don't get pushed out of the pot pre-flop, which is good news. Mm-hmm. So we go to the flop with 55-ish thousand in the pot. And the flop is 6 of clubs, 5 of clubs, 3 of spades. So I have about 80K remaining in my stack. There is, I have ace, king of hearts. And the flop is 6 of clubs, 5 of clubs, 3 of spades. I'm out of position to two players, one of whom has 50-ish thousand remaining in his stack, or sorry, 45-ish thousand remaining in his stack, and the other of whom is still gone, Guffon, who covers me.
Yeah.
I check.
Yeah, good. Yes, good.
The short stack.
I'm just saying, like, if you should have a donking range here, and probably not, but if you should, I would not put red ace-king in it. You know, even if you somehow decided that you wanted to bet ace-king sometimes here, never mind that you won't have ace-king offsuit, maybe. Or maybe you will, but it's closer. The hearts are not the ones I would bet it with. And so I am not even close to betting here.
I mean, the one argument I could see for betting is I still... Like, a very good outcome for me would be short stack shoves, Phil Galfond folds. And if I... I might make that more plausible by betting something and forcing the short stack to... Like, I think he's not likely to just call if I bet something, like, even a very small amount, like 12,000. I think the short stack is not likely to just call because that's going to be 25% of his remaining chips. So I think there's a good chance he'll either shove or fold. And if he shoves, that kind of squeezes Phil because now Phil, if like say that Phil has like nines or tens, you know, he would like to call this player, but he has to worry about me behind him. So there's a real chance that he ends up putting in like 50,000 and then committing himself for another 80, another 30 on top, I guess, when I come in. So there's a little bit of like a squeezing effect happening on him, but I think that happens anyway. Like, I think it's still kind of difficult for Phil to bet into two people who have checked. Like, I can be completely uncapped when I check. I don't think I would really lead out here if I had aces. So I think it's probably better not to have a donking range here.
Yeah, and I also think Phil doesn't really have a lot of hands that you benefit from exactly squeezing. Like he doesn't have nines. I don't know. Like, under the gun raise... Guy with 60k three bets. I'm not sure I four bet to that size with not. Eh, I don't know. Maybe he does. Maybe he doesn't. Whatever.
Yeah. I mean, call it tens or jacks. Like they're kind of equally.
Yeah.
Squeezed.
Yeah. But there's probably not that many of them.
Yeah.
Good. So yes, check. What happens?
I check the short stack checks and Phil bets about a quarter of the pot, the 12,500.
So quarter of the pot. So it's interesting. My first instinct is to fold. If you call, I would say it's because it shows some strength and it makes you look pretty unbluffable and you get to showdown sometimes against Phil, and you also don't too much risk the short stack jamming on you. Or if the short stack does jam on you, then if Phil folds, you can call. Since you're like sort of talking about this hand on air, I have a sense you didn't fold. Yeah, I mean, you know, huh, what about raising? So the, you know, raising, I guess you could have aces here. You could also just say, okay, Phil, beat queens. You know, like, that's one thing a Ray says is like, okay, Phil, Mr. Sweets or whatever, you know, if you can beat two queens, you win the money. At least that's what it looks like to me. I do think the short stack, since he's pretty likely, like, he doesn't need to check to get action, especially given the bounty effect. So the check, I think, is... I can see reasons for viewing it as pretty honest. Yeah, so I guess, and again, this is, you know, making use of the fact that that you're talking about it on air. I can see a pretty good reason to raise here, especially since like, especially if you don't have, like, the Ace King offsuit, like, Phil's going to have a harder time saying, like, especially if you might have, like, either folded or 5-bet the Ace King offsuit. I can imagine Phil, you know, then it's not like you have 16 combinations of this Ace King, you know, like, you have, like, your ranges is quite a bit stronger on this board. And when you get called, you have outs. So I'm going to say you raised. I'm going to say that the right answer is raise, although I'm not sure that's right. I don't know. I'm confused. I think it's, like, a really tricky spot. And I also think, like, Phil's bet size here is nice. Like, I think Phil is showing why he's a good player.
Yeah, so first off, I definitely agree that his bet size is nice, and it puts a lot of pressure on, especially on the short stack, but to some degree on me also, because I have to worry about the short stack behind me shoving. Even if I call the 12-5, like, the short stack might shove and reopen the betting. As you said, I actually think that's kind of unlikely. This is a flop that's not likely to improve the short stack's hand. Like, I don't think the short stack has pocket sixes that he's three betting into the under the gun opener. And I think that if the guy had, like, queens plus, he would just jam them pre-flop. Like, no one's folding to him before the flop, so he can get all the action he wants pre-flop. There's no reason for him to flat with, like, aces, kings, queens, in my opinion. So I'm not really that worried about the short stack shoving and reopening the betting. I don't think there'd be a lot of reason for me to raise here if I actually had aces or kings. The effective stacks is getting quite shallow. So if I were to call, I'm only going to have a pot-sized bet left in my stack. Like, if I call and the guy in the middle folds and I'm heads up with Phil, I only have a single pot-sized bet left in the stacks. So if I actually have aces or kings, like, I'm not really worried about Phil having a draw. I don't think he off it. You know, I think he's... I don't want to make too many strong claims about Phil Galfond, but I don't really see him having 8-7 suited here. So, I mean, I guess, like, ace-king of clubs maybe is a possibility, but I don't think he has a whole lot of draws where I have to be worried about. You know, I think often if I have aces, he has two outs. So I don't think I really need to raise my strongest hands, and I think the best way to counteract this, you know, attempt at leverage on Phil's part is just not to fold very often to it. If he wants leverage, make him put some chips in the pot, and, like, you should call and lose often when you're getting 4-1. I think especially if I can keep my range uncapped by calling, it's not like Phil is able to just barrel off into me on the next two cards. I don't think that he necessarily has a range advantage over me, or I don't think that I'm capped in a way that's going to enable him to just barrel off with abandon. If the short stack does shove and reopen the betting, I think that, you know, that puts pressure on Phil because he still has to worry about me sitting behind him with aces. I don't really see a lot of reason to have a raising range here, period. I mean, I think you're right that queens benefits a little bit more from raising, but you know, aces and kings, I think, don't benefit so much from raising, and I think I might just not have a raising range here.
Yeah, I like that.
I mean, it's not a board or a situation, really, that calls for a lot of protection. I did just call, and the short stack folds. So now we have about a single pot-sized bet remaining in the effective stacks. The turn is the deuce of diamonds. I still have ace of hearts, king of hearts. The board now is 6-5-3 deuce. Despite putting a 4-card straight on the board, I think the deuce... Well, yeah, I think that the deuce is just a blank. Like, I don't think either of us is ever going to have a 4 here. There's not even a gut shot for an ace, because since there's already the 6 on the board, like, if a 4 comes on the river, the board's just going to be 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So I think the deuce is just, like, a straight-up blank card.
Yeah, it's pretty hard for a 4-straight board to be just a whole bunch of bricks, but when neither guy has a set or a straight ever, then or a draw, like, except maybe a flush draw. Like, yeah, yeah, good. I'd start by checking, I think. Mm-hmm. I'd start by checking. He has position. You don't. You didn't turn a flush draw or anything. Not sure I'd have a donking range. Don't think I'd put this one in it if I did. He doesn't have a big range advantage over you. You certainly don't have a big range advantage over him. I don't see any reason to bet. I check. How'd I do?
Yep. I also checked in game. I think it's very clearly the right play. I think anything other than checking would be a pretty big mistake. I check, and to my delight, Phil checks behind.
Yay!
That is the best possible outcome. The turn is the Six of Hearts. Or, sorry, the river is the Six of Hearts. So the final board is 6-6-5-3 deuce. I am holding ace-king with, well, I guess there's one heart on the river, so I have 3 to a flush on the river. I'm holding ace-king. I have about a pot-sized bet remaining in my stack. What's your play?
So it's just a math question. So you will value bet sometimes. So you should bluff sometimes. You block his hands that can call. Like, he could have... Could he have checked behind aces or kings on the turn? Yes. If you bet, what hands do you want to not get called by? Like, what are the sort of close hands that you would like to be blocking? Well, maybe, like, queens, but it's hard for you to hold even one queen here. Like, in terms of hands that are actually in your range, I mean, I guess these are kind of the only bluffs you can have. So in terms of choosing bluffs, like, can you ever have ace queen suited? Hey, would you rather block a queen or a king? Hey, yeah, tough. I don't know. I do think you want to bluff here sometimes. Like, you do want a value bet here sometimes. Like, yes, if you have 2 queens, you could have played like this all along. Even though I talked about raising, sometimes you're going to just call. Even a hand like jacks, but, like, what are you doing with that hand? Fuck. Yeah, this is tough. I'll confess to being a little bit lost. I think there's a chance that the thing to do is just check again, like, even though it sort of feels like you have to value bet sometimes. I wouldn't be surprised if you actually worked out the game theory of it, if you have to just check again. Certainly if you were like 2x pot behind, a lot of things would be different if you were 2x pot behind. But if you were even a little bit deeper, I would be like really unsurprised if you had to just check again, even though it feels sort of crappy and bad. If you do decide that you have to bluff sometimes, I'm not sure any of your bluffing hands are any better than any others. So I might just flip a coin or something. I would want to know how much you have to bluff, which I don't know. I am officially confused. I think hopping up to the meta level, if I should bluff here sometimes, I'm not sure ace king of hearts is the right one to do it with. And I'm also thinking maybe this is a check all your hands spot. So in game, so to speak, in the podcast game, I'm going to check. I'm going to lock that in. That's my final answer, but I'm not sure it's right.
One thing that jumped out at me is you were talking a lot about like whether I would value bet queens. I mean, I'm more thinking about, like, I still think aces and kings are very much in my range also. Like, I'm probably not doing a lot of 5-betting pre-flop. I don't think I'm really check-raising the flop. I think I even have... Like, I'm not sure at this point that Phil's range is stronger than mine. Once he checks behind the turn... Not that he's, like, incapable of trapping, but I think he's probably a little more capped than I am once he checks behind the turn.
Yeah, fair.
I'm inclined to...
I mean, you did say that you might not find... Now. Yeah, you did say that you might not find the call pre-flop.
No, in actuality, yeah, like in terms of my actual, I have no idea. I doubt that Phil knows that Foucault 82 equals that guy whose podcast he was on last year. Yeah. So I don't think that he knows, which means he's probably assuming I'm worse than I am, if anything, which maybe makes it less likely that he's going to expect me to have, like, exploitively, but then he... Yeah, I don't know if I should get into like guessing games of what he's going to expect.
I absolutely think you shouldn't do that. Yeah. So maybe, yeah. Boy, yeah, that's tough. No, I agree. You can have some strong hands here, and I think so maybe you should have a value betting range.
So the other thing that you haven't mentioned is I think Phil has a lot of ace king in his range.
Oh yeah. Yeah, fair. Yes. Good. Probably more than you do. Like, he has more of the offsuits than you do.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. As you can probably guess, I did end up bluffing here. And I think in terms of blockers, I think like blocking aces and kings is a lot more important than blocking queens. In fact, arguably, I don't want to block queens. I certainly don't want to block jacks or tens. I don't know that I could even block jacks or tens, but you know, the hands that you really want to block are the ones that are going to be snap calls. Right? You don't necessarily, in fact, you probably don't want to block, I mean, you certainly don't want to block the snap folds, and you don't even really want to block the hands that are supposed to be indifferent to calling. You really want to block the like nuttiest portion of his range or his easiest calling hands. And so I think like blocking aces and kings is very good. Whether that's going to lead to me over bluffing when if I do have every combination of ace king in my range, I mean, I think there's some question as to whether I could have aces or kings here. I mean, I think I should, but whether I actually would, I'm not sure. Likewise, ace king offsuit, I'm not sure. If I only have the suited ace kings, it's hard for me to imagine I'm going too wrong just shoving every time I have ace king suited.
Yeah, I like that. Ooh, I did not do well with this one. I think you played good. Nice shove.
I mean, I felt good about it. He tanked for a long time and he folded, and then he and the villain were both talking. So first off, the third guy in the hand typed in chat, he was like, ah, that's one of the craziest folds. This is the guy who folded the flop, right? He's like, that's one of the craziest folds ever made in my life. Just had a bad feeling about that hand. He claimed he folded queens, which I think is insane. Like, I think he should just be shoving queens pre-flop. And I mean, I'm not thrilled about it in his shoes, but I just think it's a very clear shove pre-flop with queens for him. Like, when you have a bounty on you, it's just, yeah.
Ace king is still a hand.
and ace king is just dealt so much more often than aces and kings. Like, it's just,
yeah,
so I mean, one of us probably has, like, one of us is probably blocking the other one having aces or kings, with both me and Phil giving action. Like, if he has jacks or tens, I can see why he just calls, but I think with queens he just needs to ship it pre-flop. Certainly once he sees a flop that doesn't have an ace or king on it, he should be getting it in. I think that's a pretty big mistake on his part to fold queens. But he claimed to have folded queens, and then he and Phil were talking, and Phil said, you know, he made a pretty big fold. Also, Phil said that he had tens, which I think Phil's play is, I mean, I think it's a little debatable whether he wants to cold 4-bet tens, but it seems reasonable to me, and obviously he's Phil Galfond and I'm not, so I'm going to assume cold 4-betting tens was a good thing to do. And other than that, I think, you know, I would have done the same thing that he did with the tens. So I'm sure Phil is glad to hear that I approve of his play with the tens.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think it's very plausible that that's actually what happened. So I have not revealed the results to them, but I did thank them both for folding.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, nice hand. I'm impressed. And yeah, you play well.
It felt good. You know, I mean, just if, obviously, like, a lot of people have looked up to Phil Galfond, and maybe, I think he's actually, or not, I think, I mean, he's definitely less of a big deal as a poker player now than he was when we were coming up, but that was a real sort of, like, you know, you've made it in poker kind of moment.
Yeah, and he's, like, still a very respected poker thinker and poker guy. Like, yeah. He's not somebody who's left the game entirely. He's not somebody who's disgraced himself. Like, he's, yeah. No, I'm impressed. I'm impressed.
Thank you for letting me brag on there.
That's very good. Well, I unfortunately have an appointment I should keep. I think this has been a great episode. Do you mind wishing our listeners a good week?
I was assuming we would do that.
Yeah, very good. Well, best of luck to you. Yeah. Yeah. Have a good week, listeners, and you know, run well, enjoy Montreal. Don't miss the dumplings. Yeah, take care.
Bye. Devotion of a car, the light of the fair passage of a bill.